Welcome back to this week's episode of Rising Giants with your hosts Max Thornton and Dominic Kalusic. On the episode, we have the pleasure of speaking with Christoph Forsenetti, founder of Obor Capital. We really appreciate this episode as we dive deep into Christoph's background at an early age, what it's like being one of the earliest VCs in Cambodia's ecosystem, and learning about what it takes to be an investor in a developing market. Christoph, welcome to the show. I think a great place to start is if you could tell us a little bit about the chronology of your career and just take us back from the very beginning.
So my mother was born and grew up here in Cambodia.
Yeah.
She left during the war, 75, and she was working for the UN, so she was sent to, she couldn't choose to Congo at that time. It was Zaire. And so born there, and after that, we moved in different countries every 3-4 years. So we went from Zaire, we went to Burundi for a few years, then Burkina Faso, then Rwanda, then Kenya. And then because of the war, I had to go to France to study because there was no more school in Rwanda. But my mother actually had to stay. And so she stayed until she retired. That's probably 20 years ago.
Okay. And so
what age were you when you went to school in France?
I arrived in France, I was 14 years old.
Okay.
So spent a few years out of high school, beginning of business school. And then, but I really wanted to leave again, let's say. So did 1 year exchange program in the US, 1 year in Mexico. Then I went to work for a Silicon Valley startup in the Netherlands. Mm. Yeah, it was funny. It was the end of the 90s, internet security, cryptography. I had done my internship in Mountain View in Silicon Valley, and it was so exciting. And then they asked me to help open the office in Europe. So, and we went through an IPO at that time.
Okay, cool. That's great. That's a great context. What was it like? What was it like growing up in Africa? Like in that? So was that the 80s, would you say? I guess around about the 80s?
Yes. So from 78 up to 94. I didn't know anything else. For me, it was great. Of course, I have kids now. I can see that there's quite a difference in terms of, consumption and the pretty much everything. I mean, I had a TV that I was watching once a week on Wednesday because there was a cartoon that I like, and it was starting at 6 p.m. every Wednesday, and I could see that cartoon. When you think about, the consumption of screens today and the availability of things, it's quite funny. But no, I was happy. I had my bike. I was going around with my friends, and I guess that was the main activity. Simple but nice. But I think it's really what later, so after the Silicon Valley and all this, what drove me towards more impact, microfinance and frontier markets was this. Grew up like this, so this is really what I feel familiar and connected with.
Was there any country in those early years in Africa that really stuck out to you that you keep going back to, or like any favorites?
No, I was probably too young, and they're very different. We tend to talk about Africa but no, Burkina Faso was great. It's the Western Africa mentality, so very open, very social people. Burundi, Rwanda. Well, you've heard of the tragedy, and they're much more mountain people. You really need to scratch before you can really see the people, understand the people. They don't show off. They're very discreet and humble. So big differences. And the same for Congo, Zaire. It's the they dress up, they scream, they talk. It's very, very different. But I think I really enjoyed Rwanda, but it's probably because it was the last country I was in. Before going.
Right. And then you said you then went over to the US, right? When was that?
That was my third year of business school. I really wanted to do that program. It was called double diploma. So you do your first 2 years in France, and then you can go in two different countries. And I was really the first one to choose US and Mexico, pretty far from Europe. So 1 year in the US, 6 months in Missouri, Truman State, it's the middle of the US, so it's very different, but big campus, really enjoyed it. And then that's when I did the internship with that company called ValleyCert. It was doing validation of digital certificates. We were probably the next Google. That's what we thought at that time. And then I did, after that, 1 year in Mexico, and that was studying in Guadalajara, and then same, an internship in a tech company in Mexico City. So really focused on tech. It was the trend, you know, end of the 90s. And after that, going back to Europe in the Netherlands to work on that on the setup of that office for that startup.
At that early age, going from an internship in the US, then an internship in Mexico, what were some of the key takeaways that you had from those experiences?
Well, it was really for me the discovery of, you know, the corporate world, and starting with a startup at that time was interesting. You know, ambition was limitless. As I said, I was hired by the VP of international, brilliant guy, could speak many languages, but for him, the sky was the limit. And really, he probably was the first guy that I started to work with, and yeah, limitless ambition. So I think that was really the take with, when you look at it retrospectively, you think, wow, you know, when I was in Holland, for example, they were flying me with my computer to California for a few meetings and then sending me back. And then you understand that, hey, that's probably too much. But it's very nice to be part of that feeling at that time. And really that ambition. Mexico was, it was really to work with, let's say, different culture. Because I was a temporary project manager for Mexican developers. And so just because I was coming from Europe, was considered, you know, likely to be a manager, which I was not at all. But I mean, it was really great. And when I arrived, they just said, hey, here, this is a book of HTML4. You're going to start coding, and this project has to be ready next week. And I was like, you know, I'm interning, I'm coming from business school, I don't know anything about coding or technology. And but they didn't care. It was really about, yeah, you find a way, we don't care. So it was really, you had to do whatever needs to be done.
Okay, and how did that then lead you on to your next experience in the Netherlands?
So in the Netherlands, it was related to the first internship, the company. Yeah. So it was really about sales. It was understanding how the, you know, the Americans work. And that's very, at that time, it was very new and different in Europe. You know, in Europe, if you're a sales guy, you have to build a relationship and there is some status. I was in the inside sales team. So what was required from me was to do as many calls as possible and just make sure that I'm able to transfer some of those leads to the senior salespeople. And so this was really an eye opener because, I mean, it's really about productivity, number of calls, number of leads that you can transfer. And that, I think, changed me a lot.
The transition from going as a consultant to basically you were the CEO of opening up the second bank, that kind of transition in what seemed like such a short period of time, did you kind of feel like this was going to be a massive task to take on, or did you feel like you were ready in that moment in your career to be able to take on that challenge?
I wasn't sure. I think in Mexico, I took that consulting role just to discover, you know, the microfinance world, and I spent, if I remember correctly, probably less than a year in Mexico doing this. But I worked like crazy, and I think I was already probably a bit older than the other ones. I already had a professional experience. I had that long time of studying. The others were a bit younger, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. That was the opportunity for me to step in that group. So it was quite natural that they offered me that position. I was the one working the most, being the most involved. So it was quite normal. From there to being able to set up a bank, I have to say that was quite a gap. But that's when you understand that nothing is complicated. You arrive with, you know, a set of policies and procedures that's 500 pages. And there's just a process for this. You hire an HR company and you say, look, I have to hire 150 people. So when can you introduce me those people? I have 50 credit officers and all this. It's pretty easy. Then the manager, here is the policy and the procedure you have to put in place. We meet every couple of days to check that it's happening. It seems quite framed, I would say. You don't need to be a genius. You don't need to be to do incredible things. You just apply policies and procedures. Many people have done it before you. So the only thing that I think is important, it's the in the policies of credit, you really need to understand a little bit more the country to understand, you know, the size of the amounts, what kind of sectors can you repossess, what happens in case of default, what is the legal framework, those kind of things. But apart from that, it's all very standardized.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, that makes sense too. And especially despite having the policy handbook, it's also staying consistent and being able to work through like going to a new country, having to understand some of these other aspects that you were touching on too. You know, following that experience, this was kind of your bridge to Cambodia, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? For your next role and next position with Devenco. Is that correct?
Since the 90s, mid-90s, for a wedding, family weddings, and a few other opportunities. But it's really in 2006, we came to meet my family from Madagascar, actually. Mm-hmm. There was a flight, Madagascar, Bangkok, Phnom Penh. And I mean, once here, you see all the opportunities. And for the first time, I had that understanding of you know, the business happening around me. And I could see so many opportunities in terms of, you know, providing access to finance, because it was really the idea, providing access to finance for people that for dysfunctional countries or financial sectors in those countries. And I could see this in Cambodia, definitely. So I thought, hey, why not do it in a country that I know? And even though I'm of Cambodian origin, until that time, my relationship with Cambodia was very far. My mother was speaking to me in French, not in Khmer, and I was going to France for the holidays, not Cambodia. So it was really the first time that I was, how can I say, having a relationship with Cambodia. That's the first thing. The second one was I could see a demand for all types of businesses and services, and definitely a need for access to finance. And the third one was I wanted to start being independent. I think working in the corporate world for that fund was a great experience, but I was already thinking, hey, I want to start something by myself. I want to be an entrepreneur. So I guess those three conditions led to moving to Cambodia.
Great. And what was it like coming back and getting involved in the VC/corporate finance space? I mean, you know, 15 years ago, what is it like? How is that? What did it look like in comparison to say today?
Yeah, it's quite strange, because so when I arrived, I thought I would set up a private equity fund or a real investment vehicle. And very quickly, you understand that it's impossible. There are no large businesses that you can invest in and sit on the board and wait for, you know, dividends to come. You actually have to do it yourself. Most of the entrepreneurs, managers are very street smart, good in what they do, but there's no governance, no financials behind, no structure, no. So you have to do it. In the end, you end up spending a lot of time on this, and you're very far from investing in businesses that are already growing on their own. So you start doing everything by yourself. So it was a bit early. The answer is it was a bit early, but I thought that this environment would change very, very quickly. And it did. I think what we have today is very different from 15 years ago, but it's still a very early stage ecosystem. I mean, and you specifically know what it is. Size of the market is still limited. Size of the companies, sophistication, governance, all this still doesn't exist. That ecosystem still doesn't exist. The access to finance still doesn't exist. So I want to say that it changed a lot, but at the same time, I would still think here now. So I'm fully dedicated, and I'm Cambodian, so I want to do something for the country, but I would still think it's too early, even today, if you compare again to neighboring countries, Indonesia, Vietnam, Thailand, or others.
What do you think will kind of unlock that over the next, let's say, 5 years, to getting to that point where it will be a viable destination to set up a, you know, fully functioning, let's say, venture capital, private equity fund?
So you can see some initiatives already being put in place for that. It's really building the ecosystem. We're, as long as that ecosystem doesn't exist, you know, life cycle of a company, you need an entrepreneur that was properly educated. So we need proper education. You need to raise awareness for entrepreneurship. That mindset we have in Cambodia. But then you need that person to be able to raise a little bit of love money. He can do that to start the project. But after this, you need third parties to help you to manage your business, structure it. You need the clear and visible tax and legal framework. We're still a bit weak on this. You need VC environment so that you can get the financing to grow. It doesn't exist. Then the growth development capital doesn't exist. We only have the DFIs, and they look at much bigger deals. You need the banks to lend you, but they only lend based on collateral and land. So none of those steps, none of that ecosystem exists today. We start to have the beginning of something, and I think that's very encouraging. You have, as you know, a few incubators, accelerators. You have Khmer Enterprise putting all this together. You have an SME bank that is now set up, a few VCs, but it's still very early stage, I would say.
Okay, and maybe that brings us more specifically to like Obor and what. So understanding that Cambodia is still in this early stage, what were some of the things you did differently at Obor that would in order to compensate for that and for all these different kind of issues that you see in the market, so that you can't really be a hands-off investor?
I think we're still in a test and learn process, and very often test and fail before you understand. So investing and be very hands-on in a few projects like you know, K-Wash and Gaia, the water, the waste, that has been very interesting. But even at that size, you still need to be extremely involved and provide the services that don't exist in the company yet. I'm talking about, you know, financial modeling, helping with the tax advisory and things that the business needs, but you don't have the internal resources to do it. For K-Wash, we have it now. And Gaia still in the process. I mean, and this is for already sizable business having several million dollars of revenue. We try to venture into the startup scene, you know, investing in Cambo Ticket, Daily Shop, Shop Run Back. But, and I think we've done good because we were able to exit. We were able to show that we went through the full cycle, investing, supporting those companies, developing them, and then exiting at a profit. And we've done that. So I think we're at Obor one of the few to have done this. But retrospectively, it took a lot of time and effort. And in the end, investing a few $100,000, even if you're able to get a very decent return, doubling or tripling your money, we're still talking about a few $100,000. And if you compare this to the amount of resources that you mobilized and the time, it's an interesting KPI, but in absolute amount, it remains small and hard to be economically viable.
Are there any ways that you can you can kind of embed that into the deals that you're doing? So whereby, if you're really coming in as a hands-on investor and you're, let's say you're up against someone who's going to be a very hands-off investor who's just putting in capital, would you in that scenario expect obviously a lower valuation for you coming in, or would you also then have sweat equity in the company in order to compensate for this, like all this work that you're doing?
Yeah, I think, you know, what we're hearing today, the whole blended finance space, and how you need to really provide, how you need several type of capital providers to incentivize the others to come, that's really important. Ideally, you want to have someone supporting the investment readiness cost for a small startup so that someone is able to look at it. You want to incentivize the, let's say, the private sector or the VC to look at such a small business and make it grow. And so that has to come from less commercial capital. And that can be philanthropic capital, that can be all kinds of subsidies. But that's very much needed. Otherwise, that model is very difficult. So if you want to incentivize, let's say, a typical VC to work on small projects and young early stage startups in Cambodia, you need to subsidize a part of it, and you need to incentivize with sweat equity. So it's both.
And one quick follow up to that: would you say that, you know, given that we're still in the early innings of the startup VC space in Cambodia, and trying to really scale these like unit economic factors of growing the space, do you feel like that means new early stage players, whether that's investors, whether that's consultancy companies that will provide the consultancy services at this like investment readiness thing and governance stages, is it just a fact of there needs to be more of them that are available, or is it more of the few that are already here just need to improve quality wise?
I think it's both, but I also think it's the financing mechanism that is needed, because you have some service providers for, let's say, investment readiness or other type of support for startups. But the question is, who pays for their service? The startup can't. They don't have the resources internally, financial or human, to do this. So someone has to support that. And the VC, you know, he wants to invest in something that he understands, and he wants to spend as little time as possible on one deal with the maximum guarantees. If he has to do everything by himself, including, you know, obtaining all the information, building the model, assessing the sector and everything, it becomes impossible. So I would say you need better service providers. You need more of them, all levels. But the more important is you need a model to finance them so that they can provide those services.
Okay. And you mentioned a bit about the portfolio and what you've ended up investing in. Can you give us a bit of an understanding of, you know, why you went forward with those investments? Was there a particular sectors that you were looking at, that you were screening out? And were there particular things that you were looking for in these kinds of founders to work with that made you go forward with those investments? Just curious, like what your process was behind that.
So I have to say it was more opportunistic. KWASH is a company that I founded, so almost 10 years ago. So that was quite obvious. Gaia, I was involved in the company really at the beginning with Devenco. And so Cambodia, I think what's very important is to, once you have an understanding of a sector and you know the people, you know the sector, you know the framework for a long time, you have more certainties. Cambodia is a country where opportunities are everywhere. You look around and you can see you have 20 IDs of different businesses a minute when you're in Phnom Penh. It's always, is it the right timing? Do I have the right people to do this? For several projects we started, one of them was a chain of pharmacy called PharmaLink. We did it ourselves. It seemed like obvious that there was a need for branded and properly registered pharmacies with international standards, and we opened 5. It was too early. People still wanted to buy, you know, buy the pill. They didn't care whether your pharmacist was registered, and they were actually intimidated to step into a new, beautiful pharmacy. So we ended up selling that network to UCare. And it took many, many years before UCare, the demand at UCare was enough for them to really become what they are today. We also set up an organic fertilizer factory. I was going through the import list. Fertilizer is among the first one. This is an agriculture country. There are no competitors. It seemed like obvious, but then we didn't have the right people. That's very important. And we tried to do too many things. In Cambodia, that's another thing. We were talking about ecosystem. We had to import the equipment, set up the supply chain, collecting cow manure, rice husk to prepare, set up the recipe, prepare the packaging, distribute throughout the country, build the brand. It's too many things for one party to do. In other countries, that ecosystem is already there. You can rely and leverage on an existing network of resellers. Let's say you can use someone who's going to help you with the branding, or you actually just produce and give it to a distributor. Here, you have to do everything. So it's very difficult, even though the opportunity seems obvious and big.
Okay. And I guess, yes. Yeah, so, okay, that's talking about some of the ideas that didn't quite, you know, go as planned. But I'm curious, for the ones that you did end up investing in, and the founders that you've seen do well over time, what were some of the characteristics of those teams that you link today, that you think that was some of the reason for why they were successful?
I would say good understanding of Cambodia. To be able to understand what I just mentioned, you know, that timing, 70% or 60% of the population is still living in rural area, middle class is very small. What is your business? Who do you target, and is it scalable? If you're setting up a leasing company, a motorcycle leasing company, you know there's a demand for motorcycles, so it might work. If you're setting up a high-end product, then you know that your demand is going to be much, much smaller. So someone needs to understand the demand in Cambodia, needs to be able to really assess whether this is the right timing as well. I would say all the businesses that I've seen being successful are the ones that are implementing what we see in other countries, organization, recruiting, you know, good people around you, and really executing. The issue is there's a big issue of human resources here in Cambodia, and very often entrepreneurs end up managing too many things, handling too many things. And so I think it's important to have a team that can support you in that process.
Okay. Yeah, and what any particular red flags that you want to point out on, like, founders that you've talked to over time, that, you know, some of these tells that you get on some of these earlier meetings that you have when looking at a particular deal or business? What are some of those things to be aware of?
Yeah, I would say you have many very smart entrepreneurs. They know the sector, they know the business very well, but they're not prepared to structure it and to bring in people that you can, you know, can organize the financing, the accounting, the legal, the improve the organization in terms of efficiency and productivity. And most of the time, we're all very fascinated by people that know their business. And but if those people cannot structure their business, organize or recruit people that can do this, it's not going to work. And this is something that I've seen many times, very passionate entrepreneurs. I feel convinced by the sectors they're talking about and their vision and all this. But in the end, if they cannot execute, organize, structure, and put the hard work that is needed for that, implementing, good practices, management practices, it doesn't work.
This is actually funny. One thing that we, when we were speaking with Shivam on the podcast, we were saying about how one of these issues with in Cambodia with the founders is you do have this situation where it's sort of a one man or a one woman show, and it's the whole business is orientated around one person, and you don't have that larger team of let's say four co-founders that have all been convinced on this vision and are moving forward together. So I think that's a really good point to be aware of. And the people that are almost shouting too much and telling you that they know everything are sometimes the ones you have to, they're not always going to be the ones that will be able to convince others to join their vision, because it may already be too loud in their own mind for them to welcome others. That's an interesting point.
Yes.
Yeah. And I guess in that case too, in terms of being able to build that broader team for these earlier stage startups, what would be your suggestion in terms of either founders, where founders could be able to find those individuals or how to be able to incentivize them? Because maybe the concept of equity is a little bit, I guess it's still continuing to be better understood of how to get long-term buy-in of others to join a startup and to join this journey, but would be curious to get your thoughts on that.
We don't need to reinvent the wheel. I mean, it's just what is applied in other markets should be applied here. If you look at the sectors that have been developed early on, the telco sector, microfinance, banking, in all the largest microfinance institutions, you have very sophisticated and credible top executives. Early on in the process, 5, 10, 15 years ago, they've established employee stock options plans, and many of the employees are actually owners or shareholders of those companies. So, I mean, just that sector, microfinance and banking and telco, if you're a startup today, why not, poach someone from that sector that went through that process, that growth, with the corporate mindset, with the governance, the transparency that is required, asking to join you and to set up that ESOP that will allow you to onboard many other employees. I think it's needed. I think it's the only one to really attract talents in the longer term. So at the beginning, you need to do that.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And in terms of actually another point I was just thinking on now that Max had mentioned about our conversation with Shivam too, it's the selection of early stage startups and the framework in which you would want to think about investing in one. There's almost like a twofold nature to it, or at least something that Max and I have discussed before. It's, is this startup going to be able to scale outside into the region? And or is this going to be able to be a company that will be, cash flow generating within its sector and be a market leader there? And so it's something that we've had like discussions on, just thinking about is, how implementing that into like a screening of companies or thinking about how you would want to approach an investment, especially for new investors that are looking to go into the space and kind of wanting to get a better idea of how to look at companies. We found like those two pieces to be like good learnings for any investors that are looking to invest in Cambodia as well. I'm not sure if you feel the same sentiment as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you look at the strength that we have today in Cambodia. It's not too difficult to set up a business, to build a, let's say, an MVP, and to start looking at expanding abroad. It's probably easier to do it here, but you have to take in account, you know, if you compare to Vietnam or neighboring countries, a lower productivity, higher cost of energy, a supply chain that doesn't work that well, logistic that doesn't work as good. So you really have to ask yourself in the business, how can you use the strength that we have here in Cambodia, and are they valid? Can they be used in other country? And it's not easy, because it's very often hard to rely on the local demand this is not Indonesia with a Gojek that is able to really generate a lot of revenues before expanding outside. I don't think you can expect the largest startups in Cambodia, if you compare to the region, still have a modest size. I think a few of them could be successful in other markets, but they would not be able to rely or to capitalize on their local strength or size or cash flow.
Yeah, makes sense. And just kind of looking a little bit into the future, what would you say, you know, given the current state of the startup space and VC landscape today in Cambodia, what is your outlook on the future, say over the next few years, and how does that align with your vision at Obor?
I have no doubt on where Cambodia is going. You know, we're starting from very low. This is one of the few countries where it can only go up. There might, you know, we might have some ups and downs, and based on the internal or even the global economic environment, and we're going into one right now, actually, a bit of a downturn, but that's normal. That's cycles. But the long-term view is extremely positive. We have a large young population that will benefit from that demographic dividend. They will start consuming, they will start being extremely productive, and so there is no doubt that in the next 30 to 40 years Cambodia will experience a fast growth, a bit like, you know, I would say South Korea or other countries in the region have experienced. So that's the fundamental is there, and there is a lot of demand on many things. It's really about the timing and the ecosystem building. How much time is it going to take for a specific ecosystem or supply chain to be set up? Once it's there, then you can really leverage and capitalize on this. In our case, Obor, I think it's really two aspects. One, we want to provide financing for SMEs. We want to be able to identify the best in class in Cambodia, and we want to be able to invest and support them. We've done that in the past. I think we've learned a lot. We have a lot to share. We really want to do this. Now, to be able to do this, you know, we need to raise capital. We need to set up a fund. We need all the legal framework to be there. I mean, that's more technical, but it needs to be there before we can start that process. So that's supporting SMEs. Of course, that's a first step. That's the next 5 years, because this is the demand. SMEs, hopefully when you're a fund manager, 5 years down the road, you want to raise your second fund. That's going to be a bigger one with bigger assets, different type of assets. It can be infrastructure, it can be real estate or others. So that's the investment leg for Obor. And then there is the consulting leg, which is basically support. How do we support companies with what we've learned over the past 15 years to go through that process? Because not many people in Cambodia, we think, have been through the full cycle, that full process. How do we help entrepreneurs or teams to fundraise, structure, optimize, manage their team, incentivize their partners, and develop their business? So those are really the two legs that we are developing, we think are the most important ones. But yeah, as I said, it takes time, and you need several conditions to be met before you can do both.
And are there any sectors of particular interest that you're looking into now? I mean, maybe not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily have to be specific investment from Obor's perspective, but maybe even just from your own perspective, there are any areas that you like right now in Cambodia that you think could have that opportunity to grow and flourish, maybe at a quicker velocity compared to others?
I would naturally go in the direction of what I know well, and I know there's a demand for this. Anything related to financial inclusion, you know, from, let's say, micro insurance, crop insurance, micro insurance for agriculture, there's a need there. Financing the supply chain in a more sophisticated manner, anything related to financial inclusion makes sense to me. Infrastructure, energy, water. I mean, it's needed. Agriculture, I would like to, but can still see a lot of holes in the supply chain and how this can be scaled up. Still a lot of vulnerabilities. And one thing that I'm spending a lot of time on is really climate change. So this is a topic that I was not taking into consideration just a few years ago. And then I really started to educate myself on this. And for example, in Europe, you know, all those countries are signing those objectives, 50% decrease of emissions of CO2 by 2030, and then remain under the 2 or 1.5 degrees by 2050. The objective for each country is very significant, but none of them are putting in place the framework to do this. Now, in Europe, starting this year and next year, all the companies of more than 250 employees will have to report exactly on their emissions, so carbon footprint, not only for their activity, but for their products and also for their upstream activities, sourcing. And this is complex, to be honest. And they will have to understand it, measure it, and report it. And this is a mandatory regulatory requirement. So we can expect most of the countries, that includes Cambodia, to have to do the same very soon, with the opportunity for developing countries, you know, to do this and sell carbon credits to the more developed ones. This is that clean development mechanism. So there's an opportunity, there's a requirement. Cambodia has committed towards those, you know, net zero goals by 2050. We need to start putting in place, you know, targets and a framework to be able to do this. That's going to come very, very, very quickly. And I think so far we're not talking about it much. And so I expect this to really materialize in the next few years.
Yeah, that makes me think of one company that we had in the podcast, ATEC. And I feel like, yeah, a good example of someone that has been able to, you know, move forward on this carbon credit. This move towards being able to actually sell those and get certified for Cambodian, like for carbon credits that can be registered here. So yeah, excited to see what they do. Okay, we know we're coming up a bit on time here, so we just wanted to ask a few final questions. Really, this is like more on the interpersonal side of things that we like to ask all our guests. So one topic would be, you know, on a daily basis, how do you kind of keep up your momentum and rhythms with certain habits that you install in yourself that have kept you kind of grounded over the years? Just curious if there's any that stand out.
I think it's the same. I try not to reinvent the wheel. So early on, 20 years ago, I read everything that was, you know, available about productivity, how to manage your time, and how to build those habits that over time really improve your efficiency. And I'm pretty sure, you know, most of the effective people in senior, let's say, management positions are using those, but they're extremely useful. So, you know, always make short lists, prioritize, do the important, not the urgent, do the urgent at the end. get things done, have a balance with your family life. This is something that I've overlooked too much during too many years, and that I'm really trying to work on today. Exercise, and that's really, you know, being military about this. Every day, have an hour of exercise. Every day, read a bit. Every day, have a family time. And, you know, every morning, put a blank piece of paper and just say, today, this must be done. And even if I have to, you know, whatever the time I will finish, I need to get that thing done. Now, over the day, your list is increasing. You have 10, 20 different to-dos, but the ones that are the priorities will be done. So, you know, it's small things, but I always feel they're very, very efficient. Those small habits, I would say, are extremely useful, and they're built over time.
Okay. And is there any particular books or that you'd recommend? Like maybe what is the most formative book that's stuck with you over time?
Nothing specific. I could talk to you about the last book I'm reading, which is it's called The New Cold War, US and China. And of course, many people are talking about this, but this one is really going into the details of what is the history between the two countries, how they position themselves over the past centuries until today, and also giving a kind of assessing several scenarios in the future. I mean, are we going to a war? Is it going to be a limited war? Is it going to be just a conflictual relationship, but a collaboration with a commercial aspect that is still very, very strong? Is this a new world? Are we really splitting between two, three blocks? How do we take this in account in our business? You see that decoupling happening already. I think it's a very interesting book because it addresses three, four big trends that you really need to understand in the future. And that's everything is being digitalized. You need decarbonization, that's for sure. But it's also that decoupling. That's 3Ds actually. How do you position yourself within that new world of less globalization, and there's a change in the trading patterns, and this is a book that goes through history, sociology, everything, and gives you, doesn't say it's going to be the war, it just says you have several scenarios depending on how people will react in the future, will go in one direction.
Okay, cool. That sounds like a very topical book for the times that we live in, and also for how Cambodia is interfacing between these two countries.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And our final question we like to ask each of our guests is, what is the most important piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Take your time.
Yeah. Oh, that's a tough one. You didn't put that on the list.
We put it as just advice. So that is the question, yeah. If there's anything that just like brings to mind that you hear or you've been told and it just stuck with you.
Well, of course, there are all the usual ones, you know, take risks, don't look behind, all those things. But I think one that stayed with me quite a lot, especially because it was going against all my belief at that time, and only with age and experience I realized it was true, is one guy was telling me, stop your Excel models. If you're not able to take a piece of paper and a pen and just put the numbers of a business in three lines on a paper, don't even try to invest or do that business. And at that time, you know, I was very much into sophisticated modeling and Excel files. And I was looking at him like, you don't know what you're talking about. It's much more complex than this. And he was always like, you don't know. And if you cannot put it on a piece of paper here like this, and you don't understand it, forget it. And with, I would say 15 years later, I think he's right.
Okay. I'm sure Dom can relate on that.
I could see him smiling.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I very much. I can see where he's coming from. There is a lot of, I guess, like the that piece of advice is super important, because it's like there's beauty in simplicity, and if you make things overly complicated, then all that's really going to do is just cause a problem later down the road. And so if you can't simply be able to explain your business and what it does, and be able to just show a back napkin math P&L to someone to help them get to like evaluation, for example, then, you know, then there's probably more that you need to think about in your, about your business and how you're, you know, how you're running it versus, you know, thinking about the execution side of it. So I fully understand where that's coming from.
And you understand it.
The hardest part is to make things simple.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Yep. But that's why it's that truly is an art. So yeah, it's something that's a good takeaway, especially for anybody that is anybody that is running a business, and especially thinking about fundraising too. So but yeah, no, thank you so much for coming on to Rising Giants today with us, Christoph. We really appreciate the time, and honestly, it was a pleasure to learn more about your background, and especially your perspective on Cambodia's landscape from the early days to current day and the outlook. And, you know, really look forward to seeing everything that you continue to do over the next couple of years as well.
Pleasure.